I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello again, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us for what is the last Motorsport Magazine podcast of 2014. Oh, but we'll be back in 2015. And we might just think very quickly about who we've had on the show this year. It's quite a list. John McGuinness, Gordon Murray, Manuele Pirro, James Weaver, Andy Wallace, they came together. Perry McCarthy, Pat Simmons, Derek Bell, Jonathan Palmer, and today, David Brabham.
Ta-da!
Wow, that's a name to conjure with, isn't it? One of the big names of post-war motor racing. Brabham. I like it. We've got lots and lots of questions. We'll be with David for at least an hour today. And in case you hadn't noticed, we're all in the Christmas spirit. Aren't we, Damien?
Yes. That's as good as it gets.
And our website editor, Ed Foster, has very kindly provided some chocolate brownies, some mince pies, some wine. Good grief. But never drink while broadcasting. It's one of my rules. Okay,
it's
David.
Lucky we're so professional, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, for a change.
As a diabetic, I'm only going to be able to have the wine, not the chocolate brownies or the mince pies.
Fine.
If that's okay.
Okay. Around the table, as well as David, of course, we have our editor, Damien Smith, we have Simon Aaron, and we have, of course, the venerable Nigel Roebuck. David, you've just come back from France. What were you plotting in France?
Well, you're having red wine. I had red wine in France as well.
I bet you did.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Well, you know, obviously with our plans for the future of Brabham is to go back to racing as a team. To race at Le Mans, to race in the World Endurance Championship. So I went down to have a look at the Ligier down there, because obviously that's one of the cars that we'd be considering, as well as talking to the ACO, finding out more about their plans, what's the future look like, what are we got to be aware of. So yeah, it was very good. It was a really good trip, very worthwhile, and now back.
It's a big project, this, because motor racing is, as we all know, fiercely expensive, fiercely competitive. When did you start to hatch the plot to bring the name back into top line racing?
God, it's about 9 years ago, actually. Okay. You're probably thinking, well, what happened in those 9 years, you know? Well, it's been probably well documented, but... 9-10 years ago, I started to think ahead of time and go, what am I going to do when I stop driving? Because I'd seen a lot of drivers, including my brother, get to the end and then what? You know what I mean? And I didn't want to get into that situation. So I started to think about what it is I could do. And, I thought, well, you know what, we got this name Brabham, but as a family, we do absolutely nothing with it. You know, Dad went off and did his thing. You know, my brothers and I went off and did our thing. And there's never been any sort of group thing where, you know, Brabham is a brand, it represents everything that the brand is, and what can we do with it? So I went to Dad and said, look, you know, we should do something with this. And of course, you know, I wanted to understand what trademarks he had, because I remember sort of when Brabham finished in the early 90s, there was a lot of things going on about the ownership of the name, and you know, Dad ended up paying some money for the name. I think he was offered £1 million to get the name back.
Bet that pleased him.
Yeah, well, he wasn't going to pay that, that's for sure, as you know, as you knew Jack. But he did get it for a lot cheaper than that. But, you know, so by time I went in there to have a look at it, there were a few holes missing because, you know, for Dad, you know, he was getting older. He was sure. taking his eye off the ball on that a little bit. And someone in Germany saw an opportunity and registered Brabham and Brabham Racing, started up a business over there calling it Brabham Racing. The legend returns, was building BMW sort of M5s, pimping them up and calling them BT92. So, yeah, so... I only found that out once we'd sort of looked at the registrations, put our own in to start the protection of the name, because until I had that, I really couldn't do anything with it. So obviously discovered that this guy had rejected, there was a rejection for our application. I was like, well, who the hell is this bloke, you know? So by the time we kind of figured it out, you know, he'd launched his whole program. So the only option really was to go to court to get the name back. Yeah. And that took 7 years in the German courts to basically to get the name back. So, you know, I lost 7 years of doing anything with the name.
Good old motor racing, eh?
David, why did it take so long? How could it take 7 years?
Well, it you know, from the process of us finding out that this guy existed, then to, you know, finding out, okay, what's the process? What are we got to do? You know, I ended up, you know, getting a lawyer here in the UK, which then had to have a lawyer in Germany. And so, you know, we went through the process. We ended up going to court. We ended up winning the first court case, but because they appealed. So then it had to go to the higher court of Germany, and these things just take ages before they come round again, you know. And you've got to do your homework, and you know, at the time, I mean, you know, I never realized how expensive going to court was, you know what I mean? It was horrendous. Luckily I had two racing programs kind of going on at the height of it. It was 2009 when I was racing in America with Highcroft and Le Mans with Peugeot, which, you know, was super, super stressful. And it was bloody difficult, yeah. You know what I mean?
But the good thing is you've done it. You've done it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, once we went through the second, third time of court, you know, we finally won. And then it took nearly 8-9 months for after the court case for the name to finally come back. Yeah. To us, and then it was a case of, okay, what do we do with it? Now we've got it. And of course, you know, I see a lot of brands, and you know, you see them in you know, walking down the high street, and you see motor racing brands as well. You know, what is the message they're giving me?
What is the Brabham brand message? Is it sideways, gritty, and
yeah, no, well, we did. What I did do is I got someone in who was a brand expert. And said, you know, tell me what Brabham is. What do people think and feel about the brand? And basically after about 15 months of research and interviewing, you know, fans and Brabham owners and people within the sport, people Dad worked with, people I worked with, you know, we really did our homework on what the brand represents. And it's inspirational, it's pioneering, innovation. Sure. Engineering.
Absolutely.
They were the core messages. They were the DNA of what Brabham is.
Absolutely.
So, and of course, when Dad died, all the magazines, that's all you saw was those headlines underneath Jack's picture. Yeah. So, you know, we got our branding right. And so then it was a case of, okay, now we understand what that is. We have to come back into racing. But as I've said many times before, you know, for race teams to survive just as a race team year in, year out is a really tough industry for teams to survive. Did I want to bring Brabham back into that industry like that, or should we be looking at something different? Is there an opportunity for Brabham as a brand to come back into racing and do something like it did years ago and was a game changer? Can we do something now? And this is where, you know, Project Brabham came about. where we've come in and said, you know, we're going to open the doors, we're going to, you know, inspire, you know, fans to be involved, you know, come up with, you know, communication between the fans and the team and make decisions together and things like that. And, you know, I've got 31 years of knowledge of a racing driver as a professional driver for a long time. What does it take? You know, we're going to create Brabham Digital, which is, you know, for fans and the drivers, and of course with engineers, to inspire engineers as well through racing, so people learn and experience through the team with an open door.
How far is Australia involved? Because Australia is such a big part of the whole background to the thing, isn't it? Or is this a very British Brabham?
Well, it's a very David Brabham program, put it that way. Yes, I was born here. I was raised in Australia. I've spent more time here in the UK. I've travelled the world. I see myself more as a world citizen, more than one particular country. And this program is a global initiative.
Fantastic. Good.
Does the launch of this program, David, you said you were looking for something to do once you stop driving. Does this mean you're actively now looking at winding down your own racing career, or...
Well, if you've noticed, I haven't done a lot the last 2 years.
But you are still involved.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've done three races this year, big races. It's like Daytona 24 Hours, Sebring, which we nearly won, and the World Endurance Championship at Shanghai just the other month. So, yeah, it was good to keep my eye in and everything. But for the last 2 years, I've only done six or seven races. Because my main focus, you know, I had to come to a point where, right, I've just got to park my driving and just get this program up and running.
Have you drawn a line under it then now?
No, I haven't drawn a complete line under it right now. But, you know, getting more and more involved in what this is going to take. It's not just starting a race team. It's also creating Brabham Digital and what the content... I mean, it's a massive, massive program. So... I guess if you were me and I'm interviewing me and I'm saying, hey, what, you want a job with me? Tell me about what your days are like, you know, how committed are you as a racing driver? I'd probably be struggling to employ myself.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Can we go back in time a bit? Because you were into football, weren't you, when you were a youngster?
I was. I was the Ryan Giggs.
Were you now?
Of Gawley Bay in Australia. Yeah. Okay. In
you were one of Manchester United's local fans then, I guess.
Yes, I was. Yes, very much so. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, no, well. I mean, when I... It's funny, you know, because, like, I obviously grew up in a family full of racing, but it didn't really interest me. You know, it was just, there was beautiful trophies that people would just stare and look at. And I just walked past like they were objects because they didn't mean anything, really. You know, I was 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, when all that was happening. But I had a football in my hand and I'd go out every day and play football. And, you know, we had a really, really cracking team where, you know, when I was seven, I scored something like 38 goals in my first season. And I started off in the seven C's. I went to the eight A's after that, and we won everything, absolutely everything. And then 9, 10, 11, and 12 years of age, we always made the final. We choked every time. but you know, we were one of the strongest teams, and that was my passion. That's all I thought about. And then my family decided that I needed to follow Gary and go farming and go to an agricultural boarding school. Where they didn't really play soccer, they just played Aussie rules. So I learned, you know, my soccer was finished. I did have asthma as a kid as well for about 7 years during the time I played, and I went for a trial, but I had an asthma attack, so it never happened. Yeah.
So what? How did
probably
it,
luckily
how,
so?
How did it go from football to agriculture to motor racing, where I guess it was pretty much going to end up, wasn't it, in the end?
Well, I mean, I never, even during at school, I never thought, oh, I'm going to be a racing driver. I was groomed to be a farmer. We had a 4,500-acre farm at near a place called Wagga Wagga in Australia. And, you know, my two brothers were racing, so I was the last one in the chain that Dad thought, right, well, at least one of them's not interested in racing. But what I was interested while I was growing up on the farm and at school was speed, right. Because I just loved getting in a farm vehicle, a tractor, a motorbike. It didn't matter what it was. It had to be from A to B as fast as possible and as sideways as I could. You know what I mean? So I should have been a rally driver.
But you still weren't putting that together with being a racing driver.
No, didn't even think
sounds
about
more like
it.
Ryan Giggs actually to me.
Well, what, the thing was, you know, when you asked how it kind of went from one to the other. Yeah. I left school at 16 and then went to a college to learn about wool, to be a wool classer. Dad didn't want to pay for a wool classer, so he thought I'd be quite good at that. And I'd be there looking at all the microns and everything of what the wool was and putting them into categories. So, but then I went and spent 3 months in America, which was my first big trip away from Australia. And my brother Jeffrey was racing in IndyCars in 82. And that was really, for me, the first time I really saw racing for the first time. And he was asked to help Al Unser Jr. win the Can-Am Championship with the Gallus and the Frisbee. Do you remember the Frisbee? So Jeffrey had won the Can-Am Championship for VDS the year before in 81. So they brought him in to sort of with a second car to help Al Jr. And so he said, you want to come along and you know, have a look? You know, so I thought, yeah, great. So I went and had a look and he was in the seat, you know, getting his seat done. And I wandered around the workshop, which was one of the first workshops I'd ever been to. In a race team, there was a go-kart sitting over in the corner with a mechanic working on it. And of course, I wander over there and I'm looking at this go-kart. And the first words out of my mouth were, "Do people race go-karts?" Exactly. And the bloke turned around and said, "Are you adopted?" So it's like, I said, no, I'm not. You know, but he just couldn't work out. You know, my brother Jeff's there. I'm his younger brother. And I don't even know people race go-karts at 16, 17 years of age. No idea. Problem is, that was the moment. That was the spark, the change. You know, sometimes you go along life and something happens and you go on a different path. I just thought, you know, I loved driving fast anyway. So it was like, right, okay, I wouldn't mind having a go at that. Of course, when I went back to Australia and sat down with Dad and said, I'd really like to have a go in a go-kart, you could imagine the look on his face, couldn't you? It wasn't full of smiles and, oh, yes, he wants to be a racing driver. It was like, you've got to be kidding. So
he didn't want to pay for that either, did he?
No, he didn't, because I convinced my neighbour who I went to school with, which was about 3 hours away from the farm, and we were at boarding school together, and we actually bought a secondhand go kart together, and we went off racing without Dad's help or influence.
Fantastic!
You know?
Yeah. Brilliant. Mike Thakwell got involved early on, didn't he? You the laser championship, have I got this right?
No. Mike Thakwell, my brother-in-law, because I married his sister, Lisa. When I obviously went through karting, Formula Ford, and Graham Watson, who was running Rolt Australia, wanted to go over to do the Tasman series, and he wanted to take me in a Formula Ford and my brother Gary in a former Atlantic car, and Mike Thakwell was going to be the other driver.
Right, okay.
I did a test at Oran Park in a former Atlantic car, and test went really well. I would have put it like P3 on the grid from the previous race, and they said, right, you're coming with us in the Atlantic car. So that was the end of my Formula Ford career. And I went off and I was a teammate for a month racing all around New Zealand with, you know, a real legend of our sport. You know, he was incredibly fast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And yes, he was right at the, you know, kind of like he was 26 when he retired. So it was 25 when I saw him.
Yeah.
And he was on it. Yeah. I learned a lot. You know, he was weird, but I learned a lot. As a lot of journalists will probably say,
Yes.
Well, Rob interviewed him a couple of years ago, didn't you? And
well, yeah, partly thanks to some help from David, actually.
Yeah.
Finally tracked him down.
But he was great, wasn't he? Great.
Fantastic. I like him a lot, yeah. But maybe I'm weird, but I like him a lot.
He's good weird. You know, he's good weird. Let's face it. Yeah. I mean, he's not weird. He's just a really interesting character, and he just does what he wants to do. Absolutely. He walked away from the sport at his peak, absolutely, never turned back, never got back in a car again, which takes some, you know what I mean?
And actually, it doesn't give you the impression that he regrets it at all.
No. It's no change of life, different aspirations. He, you know, he went, you know, North Sea helicopter, you know, flying, and you know, worked with, you know, learned sign language. Then he did scaffolding work in Perth, he surfs a lot. He's always been a surfer.
Yeah, I wish he'd come in and talk to us actually, because he's good fun.
Well, I mean, I don't know if he would, but you know, he's always been a bit shy in that area. Yep. You were lucky to get an interview with him.
I was that? Well, it took me quite a long time actually.
It was interesting. I was talking to, when I interviewed your son Sam about his Formula Ford program earlier this year, we were chatting about stuff. He said there was a day in his, when he was still karting, that none of the family were available to take him to Bayford Meadows. And Mike said he'd do it. And Mike gave him a lift there. And he'd never related Mike really to motor racing. And he said they got there and they started doing a track walk. And he said for the first time, he's like, you know, to me, it was just Uncle Mike. But then suddenly he became alive with, right, turn in here and you do this. And he'd never seen that side of him at all, he said.
Yes, I think Sam will remember that day forever. Yeah, he just thought it was a fantastic day, because obviously father-son relationship doesn't always go smoothly at a racetrack, you know, especially for myself. But because I'm quite hard on Sam and I push him, you know, a lot. And for Mike, you know, it was a different ball game, and he really enjoyed the day. And, you know, I think all those things came out in Mike that, you know, I think it was a great day for Mike and for Sam. Yeah,
sounds like war's broken out here.
Yeah, it does a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, hopefully it hasn't. Is this the Project Brabham thing? Is it partly with Sam in mind as well? Because I mean, if you wanted to be really optimistic and creative, you could think of Sam Brabham in a Grand Prix Brabham or something.
Well, there's a lot of things that made this sort of a reality in my mind, you know. And it was, yes, you know, what do I do at the end of my career? What has the family got moving forward as, you know, something that they can work towards, in a sense, you know. Nothing was created before that, you know, with Dad's era or anything like that. You know, how do we carry the legacy forward? How do we create a business for the family for generations? Things, all those things sort of came in. And, of course, you know, I've got sons, and one's racing, one's into cricket, but you know, it's something that potentially that he could be involved in. But like, you know, like I said, I'm pretty tough. You know, I said, hey, if you're not on it and you're not an asset to the team, there is no reason why you would be in our program. If you are, you're on it, you're serious, and you're an asset, and you're a Brabham, well, that's a bonus.
I actually asked Sam that very question last Sunday, and he said he badges you about it every sort of 5-10 minutes or so. And he said you said to him, prove yourself, and you got a chance, which I think is absolutely great.
Absolutely.
It's quite right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I see a lot of fathers in the industry who all they can see is this wonderful son that can't do anything wrong. You know, I'm a little bit the opposite. I probably need to back off and a bit.
He did mention that as well.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I bet he did. Yeah, but you know, he's a great kid, and I can see he's definitely got the Brabham genes in terms of, you know, ability and speed and awareness and feel for the car. I've with the court case, you know, I didn't have much money to take him racing, so he's had a limited program, you know. So you know, for what he's done a good job. You know, he needs a break, he needs a proper program to really see what he can do. And if he gets that and he really shows his abilities, then he would be someone we would consider.
You should have had a word with Bernie about the court case. He's good at sorting out German courts.
Yeah,
in very little time.
I'm sure he's paid a lot more money than I have.
what's it like watching Sam come through the ranks now compared to when you were doing it? I mean, it's always been hard, the single seater ladder. It's never been easy. Is it harder now, or is it the same? How would you rank it?
Well, for me, I can only talk through my own experiences. And you know, when I came over on a free drive, because Camel was sponsoring Sons of Famous Drivers, so that was my opportunity to come over here and do Vauxhall Lotus with Derek Bell Racing and Justin Bell. And then I went for a drive for the Juicen drive in with Bowman in F3 in 89, and there was five of us going for a competition. I won that mainly because I was the only one that actually answered the question, what is juicing, where the other four said, I don't know.
That is hard to believe, actually.
Well, it's funny, you know. I mean, it just shows you, like, preparation. You got to think ahead, you know. And
they're builders' merchants, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So I just come from Australia, you know, because it's like juicing. What the hell are juicing? You know, when I was, you know, said, you know, you're up for the drive. Juicing's the sponsor. I thought, well, I don't know what they are. I better go and find out what they are. You know,
do so your juicing homework.
Exactly. Yeah. So I ended up, you know, getting some bump from them and walking into a store and looking around. And of course, when the question came to me, what is juicing? I thought, now how do I put this into words? And I just, you know, sometimes something just comes to you right at the right time. As well, when I think of juicing, I think of a home. And it just ticked
smooth.
The box. Exactly. Very smooth. I don't know where it came from, but it came from somewhere. And of course we had a driving test as well, and I'd done Class B the year before, so I was used to the Formula 3, done Atlantic, so it was a bit of a step down anyway. So I got the drive, and I've been a paid professional. I even got paid doing F3. And since those days, I've just been on this great run, really, of a paid professional. And at that day, you had Juicens, you had Marlborough, you had Camel, you had Cellnet, you had opportunities to get drives for free.
Yeah, exactly.
A great time back then. We were on BBC, you know, prime time television.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, it is, you know, down to wealthy parents that can afford to go racing. So I think for Sam and not just Sam, but, you know, kids his age and in his situation and others, you know, I think it is tougher. Yeah, definitely.
We had a question. We've got lots of questions from our readers and our listeners, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one here from Anthony B. I don't know why people can't give their names when they ask a question. Anyway, Anthony B. asks, was it harder to qualify for a Laser Series race back in 85 or a Grand Prix in 1990? Oh, that's quite a good question, actually.
No, believe me, the Lasers were a lot easier. Yeah, a lot easier. I mean, you know, when I went to Formula One, in 1990, I wouldn't say I was ready, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, I just felt a year of F3000 would have been good, and that was the plan, to do that with Middlebridge, and then they bought Brabham. They stopped the 3000 program, so Damon Hill and I were going to be teammates. And they did actually ask me to do Phoenix, the first round, literally that week of the race. I was supposed to be doing 3000. That was, my head was into that. Phone rings, Dennis Nursey's on the phone, and he says, how do you like to come out, do the first race in Phoenix? And I thought about it for a second. I said, no, thank you. And they went, what? I said, well, one, I'm not ready. I'm not fit enough. You know, I was unprepared, and I just didn't feel that I could do the job justice based off the running that I'd had in any sort of 3000 cars. So I said no, and then you know, after two races, that's when they stopped our program and they said, look, you know, we want you in Formula One. I had no option, you know, go for a look for another driver or be a Formula One driver in a Brabham. Kind of tempting at that point, yeah. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, you had pre-qualifying, you had 30 cars going for 26 slots, and you know, Brabham at the time, you know, were on the decline. You know, unfortunately, the BT58, which was the year Stefano Modena and Martin Brundle, you know, had some cracking races. I think Martin was third at Monaco that year. Yeah, and I drove that car at Silverstone. It was my first F1 car, and it was a beautiful car. It was just a dream to drive. It was so easy. Then the BT59 came out, and it was half ready. The gearbox wasn't ready, so they put the old gearbox on, and the aero was not right. And, you know, I talked to Sergio Rindlin, who designed it back then, and, you know, he said it was the worst car he ever designed. You know, it was just... It was, unfortunately, they ran out of money pretty much halfway through the year.
It was
a very difficult situation, yeah.
What was it like in the family during that whole period where Brabham was kind of, you know, you thought it was going to disappear any minute. It was bought by this person, then this person. Bernie Ecclestone had it for a while.
Well, when Bernie had it, to be fair, it worked. You know what I mean? They were still a good team.
Yeah,
you know,
very successful.
Yeah, very successful in the PK era, for sure. But then, of course, you had different owners before I got there. Yeah. And unfortunately, it was just slipping away. And it was affecting my father's other businesses.
Yeah, I wondered
about
that.
Yeah, it did, because people would ring up and say, you know, what's happening with Brabham? Because I hear there's a lot of problems, and thinking it was my dad's businesses, you know what I mean? So it was not an easy situation for the family to sort of see the name go down like it did. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It wasn't good. And there was nothing we could do about it.
Did your dad talk to Bernie Ecclestone about all that? Because it was when Bernie decided to sell it was the time it started to go a bit pear-shaped, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was. But I don't, you know, Dad was not interested in doing anything in with a Formula One team. You know, just that just wasn't him. You know, he'd done all that, it is.
No, absolutely. Yeah, but his name was all
right. Well, it hurt him. I know it hurt him.
Yeah,
it did hurt him. And that's that what's, when it did fold, that's what motivated him to get hold of the name as best he could at the time to stop it from, you know, damaging his other businesses and things like that.
Actually, a story that comes back to me, we were talking earlier on about the importance of Brabham as a brand. When Bernie bought it, well, it was, what, 70, what, 71?
In the 70, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. My old friend Alan Henry went to interview Bernie at around that time when he just acquired it. At one point in the interview, he says to Bernie, so, anyway, Bernie, what are you going to call it? And there was a silence, and Bernie just looked at him as if he was a half-wit, and he said, Brabham, Alan. He said, if you and I bought Marks and Spencers, will we call it Eccleston and Henry?
Yeah, well, you know, it kind of sums it up, though. I mean, back then, the name Brabham was one of the biggest in the sport, you know.
Nigel will be publishing his book of Christmas Ecclestone jokes later this month, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, actually, I was talking to Ron Turinet, and he never quite told me the full story of what happened there, but he did say he got stitched.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, last minute deal, 50% offer came in. What the hell? Then he took it, you know. But you know, you know, Bernie.
Let's talk about a little bit about Jaguar. It's you're associated with that. I think if you before the podcast, you're going to think, what are the immediate things you think about? How did that come about, getting into the big sports cars?
Well, there was some discussions, I know, at TWR at the time about drivers, and Fiona Miller at the time said to Tom, what about David Brabham? So I got invited to do the XJR 15 Intercontinental Cup, which was the three races at Monaco, Silverstone and Spa. Yeah. million dollar prize fund for who won Spa, you know. So I was lucky enough to be invited to do that. That was in 91, and that by that time I'd come out of Formula One because I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
So I was doing a sort of part program in 3000 with Team Roney. And they said, oh, would you like to do this championship? You know, and I thought, great opportunity. So I went to Monaco to do the race, and I actually finished second behind Derek Warwick.
Yes.
And after the race, they said, oh, how would you like to come and drive the XJR 14 at a test? Well, by that, you know, that time, that thing was just the talk of motorsport, wasn't
Absolutely.
It? I mean, it was just amazing. And so they didn't say anything more than that. They just said, would you like to come do a test? So I said, well, let me think about that, yes. they said, right, call us next week when you get back from Monaco. So straight on the phone. And I said, now I'm ringing up about the test, thinking, you know, things can change and whatever. And they said, well, there's no point you testing for us if you're not going to drive for us. I said, are you offering me a drive? And they said,
as we say in Australia.
Yeah. And they said, yes. And I mean, that was like a complete bolt out of the blue, you know what I mean? Because they needed someone to replace Martin Brundle, who was doing a joint F1 sports car campaign. And because Tom wouldn't pay for four drivers, he only would only pay for three. So you know, what, Martin or myself would start in one car and finish in the other. So I remember going there to the first test. Ross Brawn was there because it was the last car he ever penciled, apparently. And I just couldn't believe the performance of the car. It was just amazing. It really was. And went to Nürburgring and I finished first and second.
Derek Warwick said...
It's funny, actually, that car, David. Everybody who ever drove it seems to say the same thing. They were just startled by it the first time they drove it.
Yeah, I think if you ask anyone who drove that car, with all the cars they've driven in their life, what's the one car that just sticks up in your mind as something special? All of us would probably
certainly
say that
without
car.
Without a doubt, Martin does.
Yeah, without a doubt, I do as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Good old Ross Brawn, eh?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, they had a great team there. And for me, that was my first introduction to a professional race team. You know, because Brabham was a little bit of in a disarray at the time. You know, lots of money problems, whatever. But, you know, this was a proper program, you know, working with people like Ross, John McLaughlin and Steve Farrell, the engineers, Roger Silman, all those guys, Tony Dow, because I did some stuff in America with Tony. And, yeah, I mean, that was a really good thing for me. And then to work with Teo Fabi and Derek Warwick as well, driving each other's car. They had completely different driving styles, so the setups were completely different. And that taught me to be adaptable in that period, because I went on to drive lots of different cars, you know, quite well. So I think that really taught me how to adapt as a driver.
Interesting. Yeah. It was a watershed moment.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and it saved my career. You know, because it was going nowhere for a period of time. And then, you know, Jaguar came along and, you know, I was there to help them win the World Championship, which we did.
In 94, you went back into Formula One. Why?
Why not?
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what? I mean, it felt a bit like unfinished business, you know. There was an opportunity to get back into Formula One.
But again, not a great team, not a big team.
No, it was a small team, underfunded, you know, but there was no other option. You know what I mean? It was like, well, give it a go, you know. Okay. Don't be frightened of it. Just let's see what we can do with it, you know. And obviously, you know, from a financial point of view, it was very difficult. Obviously, with Roland's accident at Imola, you know, not an easy situation for any of us to deal with. But we got through to the end of the year. Don't know how, but we did. And, you know, for me, that was pretty much the end of my Formula One career. You know, like I said, I've never bought money to a team. I've always been a paid driver. Never had the kind of backing to take me to a particular big team or anything like that. In fact, in 91, I had the chance to drive the Jordan.
Really?
Yeah, I just needed $500,000 at the time.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Over 10 laps.
Yeah, maybe.
I was going to say,
I didn't get to that far down the line with the conversation, you know, with Eddie, but that was an opportunity.
You can have the Wednesday morning. That's right.
All right, yeah. This is the $500,000, and then we'll talk about the next day. Yeah, exactly. So, that was an opportunity, but, you know, just didn't happen.
David, just going back to the, I know it's a slightly morbid subject, but the Imola 94, everyone focuses on the Ayrton's accident. People do remember Roland, but what was it like? People focus less on Simtek, really. I mean, how did that weekend unravel for you? I mean, how did you all cope with that?
I don't know how we all coped with it, because we, you know, when something like that happens and you've never, ever had an experience of it before, what the hell do you do? You know, if it happened now, I know what to do. You know what I mean? I know how to think. I know how to react. I know the people around me, who I've got to speak to, how I've got to put an arm around or whatever. But back then, you're stunned. You're just in a state of shock. The whole team was. Formula One was. The world was. You know, all of a sudden, we'd had a Formula One driver die, and it was my teammate. You know, I never had a teammate go. So it was very difficult. But, you know, there's something deep down inside you that knows you've just got to keep going. You know, it can't defeat you. It's just, you've just got to keep it going. That's why I raced the next day, you know, which was kind of an unusual thing at the time to do, because most people would have packed up and left, you know. But, you know, we did the warm-up and came in, and we actually were fairly competitive. Don't know why, probably they put me on empty tanks or something, I don't know. But I came in and I wasn't right mentally, but we were fast enough to, when I came in, that just slightly lifted the team a little bit. And I thought, I've got to race for them. You know, I've got to. And that was my way, I think, of not focusing on the situation. It was, right, I've got to do this for the team. Let's go, let's keep going, you know. Because I know Roland, he would have said, get on with it. You know what I mean? And it's life. These things happen. And, you know, for us, it was a new experience, not easy at the time, but it taught all of us something out of it. It taught Formula One something out of it, because things changed quite rapidly after that weekend in terms of safety. And it probably saved many lives afterwards. Many lives. So it was a, you know, like, there is a silver lining through dark cloud, and that a lot of really good things really came out of it. Yeah.
When you started the race, because the thing that always comes, the thing about, I mean, I'll never forget that weekend, because it just seemed to be, well, what conceivably is going to happen next? But, you know, there were even the accident away from the start. I mean, that was a big accident, and I was going to say, you must have been in the middle of all that. So I was going to say,
I remember thinking,
in your state of mind, how did you sort of deal with that?
I think because you are racing, you know, there's that mentality where you know what you've got to do, you know how you've got to focus. It wasn't easy to have that clarity in your mind, because you're cluttered with so many things going on at that time. I was lucky in the race that I had a race with Eric Bernard and Alige. Normally, we didn't really race with anyone. We just got in everyone's way. I actually had a race with someone, which was a real plus, you know. And then, I had a steering failure in the end. And, luckily, I didn't hurt myself. But, you know, it was one of those where you just got out of the car and you just thought, I just need to get out of here. Yeah. You know, you just had to kind of escape, really, just because there was just too much going on. The adrenaline. Even when I was dicing with Eric Bernard, my right foot on the accelerator was bouncing up and down. I had absolutely no control of my right leg, other than I knew I had to keep it flat on the straights. But it was just bouncing up and down. The adrenaline was all over the place. You know, I was a bit all over the place, yeah.
Let's take another question. And this comes from Peter Bukovkan. And he begins by saying how much he loved your father's career and your career. And I think we all feel that way.
Thank you.
He wants to know what the 94 breed of Formula One car was like to drive. You know, was it a bit of a magic carpet ride? Well, actually, yours wasn't.
Well, actually, our biggest problem was downforce and power, clearly. It wasn't an evil car to drive. It was just slow. you know, and what made a lot of cars more difficult to drive was when they changed the rules like that.
Yeah.
Because they did some stuff at the floor, they cut diffusers down, they did all sorts of things to slow the speeds down. And of course, you know, that just completely upsets your aero balance and everything, even weight distribution and all that sort of thing. So for us as a small team, you know, it took a while to try and adapt as we went along because we couldn't test. We didn't have the money to test. So we were testing at the racetrack, you know. And the cars got more difficult after those rule changes, for sure.
Interesting. Another one comes from Sombrero, his name is.
No surname?
Sombrero Smith, I believe. Yeah.
Or no Christian hat. Name. One of the yes. Mr. Mexican Hat.
Yes.
Anyway, Sombrero, thanks for the question. Only joking. He wants you to talk a bit about Audi at Le Mans. And his question is very, very simple. Why are they so, so good at it?
Well, you know, I've been racing against Audi for a long time. And when in the Panos days, you could beat them. You know, they even well, though there was
that, yeah, he's coming to that. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, in those days, in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, early 2000s, you could do something. You know, you could if they just faltered a bit.
You're in.
Jan Magnussen and myself would just pounce, you know, and we could do it. And I've just seen this progression. They've just got better and better. You've got to think they've been at it for a long time now. They spend vast amounts of money doing it now.
With looking from Panos, I mean, what were you seeing that other teams weren't doing?
I think when we had a competitive car back in those days, Audi were still learning about sports cars.
Yeah.
When the R8 came out, you know, that thing just got better and better and better. And I actually had the privilege of driving it at Jerez in 2003 when I joined Bentley. We were all testing there. It was the first test for the new Bentley, which Johnny crashed, so we never got to drive it after he was trashed it after six laps or something in a brand new car and broke the tub. So so I ended up being a spectator, and then they asked me at the end of the test, would you like to jump in the R8, which I thought, well, that's the thing I've always been trying to beat. I jumped in it, and I thought, oh, no wonder this thing is so... It was just so easy to drive, you know, and the engine was just amazing, you know.
Alan McNish says it's the best one, the best they ever built, he reckons.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I've not driven the others, obviously, but not sure. It was a very successful car, very reliable, very easy to drive. And I think they started to get it at that point. And, you know, when you looked, you know, the diesel power, they've had a big advantage for such a long period of time. Without a doubt, I didn't realize that until I drove for Peugeot in 2009 and felt what diesel power was like. Yeah. It was a different world. So, you know, in terms of the power advantage, the amount of money they spent, you know, when you look at it now, what they spend... not only on the car, but just the hospitality at Le Mans is 10 times more than the budgets that people are running just to do the whole year, you know.
And fantastic attention to detail.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, they've got it right. You know, they know how to win. They know how to win now. You know, okay, they didn't win this year. You know, Toyota did a very good job, for sure. They were still strong, still finished second, but... yeah, they've had a fantastic run, and they've been very difficult to beat.
Sombrero also has a question about Peugeot, actually. He wants to know, why was it that the foreign-driven... I'm not quite sure what he means, actually. The foreign-driven 908 was the fastest car in 2009.
What do you think that means, though?
Well, I think it means the one that was not driven by French drivers.
Yes, exactly.
Is what he's saying.
Exactly.
Well, we weren't the quickest. We weren't the quickest.
Okay.
We won, but we weren't the quickest.
You had the less problems.
Yeah, we had a perfect race. Yeah. It was very clear that we were not the car to win. Car 7, French drivers, French team. You know, it's pretty well documented. That was the one they wanted to win. I was intrigued by the politics that was going on at that time. And I saw that that was actually to our advantage, because the Car 9 with Alex Wirtz, myself and Mark Janay, you know, we had an engineer that came from rallying, never done them on before, never done sports cars before. So you could see the importance of our car, you know what I mean? But what they didn't realize is that they gave us an opportunity, because we could separate ourselves from some of the other stuff that was going on. We just focused on what we had to do. We figured out that the splitters were breaking if you went on the curbs too much. So we made a pact that we wouldn't bounce all over the curbs. It meant we lost time, quite a lot of time, but the other cars kept having to come in and changing splitters, and that's where they lost a lot of their time. So, you know, Alex and Mark did a fantastic job. The engineer that we had learnt very quickly. In fact, he had chicken pox before the event, and he turned up on the Thursday. So we on the Friday he turned up. So we virtually were running without an engineer to begin with. It sounds weird with the big factory Peugeot team, doesn't it? But, you know, we were experienced campaigners. We knew what we wanted. And he turned up with spots all over him. And he was, you know, you could see he was not right. But he had to be there. And full credit to him, because, you know, he took the helm then. And we won the race.
Fantastic. Yeah. It's a great win.
It was an unbelievable win. And we nearly didn't win by about... probably 10 metres, which people don't realise. Yeah, we nearly lost by 10 metres of track because of a safety car at the end.
Yeah.
And we came in for a pit stop. And as Mark Janay drove out, the safety car was going down the pit straight, and we were literally one or two car lengths in front of it. And if we were just that little bit behind, we would have had to have stopped. Car 7 was in that lineup. It then would have been in front, and we would have had to have waited to be behind the queue. It was getting close to the end of the race. We just got out in front, ended up at the back of the queue halfway around the lap. And of course, for them, for Peugeot then, that, you know, they after that, they said, okay, no more racing.
Yeah. I'm interested, when you said when you first drove it, I mean, it sounds as though the horsepower was took you by surprise.
It did.
It really did.
I drove out of the pits at Barcelona for the first test. By the time I got out of the pits and accelerated and got to the first corner, you should have seen the grin on my face. It was huge, because I just thought, I can win Le Mans with this. You know what I mean? It just pushed me back into the seat. And it was an interesting situation, because I was actually driving for an opposition manufacturer with Honda in America. We were racing against each other at Sebring. And, you know, I remember, well, one, it was a surprise getting the email from Peugeot. And I was at Sebring just about to do our first test. And this email came through from Serge Saunier. And I opened it, and it said, what is your contractual arrangements re Le Mans? And I was like, well, you know, I had to read it twice. And, well, of course, I had to find out what that was all about. And I was free for Le Mans as long as Highcroft and Honda said it was okay. Now, they weren't doing Le Mans. Within 2 days, I got the okay. And then I went to have a meeting, and Bruno Famin was in the meeting as well. And he was a little bit, you know, unsure about me being in their car, being with another opposition team, and he did say that to me. He said, I'm not sure about this. And I just said to him, the very fact that I'm in your office talking to you about this, do you not think this kind of highlights the way I go about my racing? He didn't have a response to that. And, you know, I never put any secrets across either side. It just not, that's not what you do. If I did that, then my name would have been mud afterwards, you know, and my career would have been in trouble. So, you know, we kept everything above board. And to be fair, not Peugeot, not Honda asked me once about the opposition. So everybody was very much above board.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, it was. It was really good. And of course, you know, I got to thank Highcroft and Honda for giving me the opportunity too. Yeah.
You must have thought before that came up that the chance of an overall Le Mans win was probably gone, didn't you? I mean, it was...
What, before that? Or
yeah,
before yeah, that. I mean, you know, I've done 18 Le Mans, and I've really only had two chances of winning. One was with Bentley in 03, and finished second. So I was gutted after that race, because I knew we had I had a 50% chance of winning. We were so much quicker than everyone else. We had problems, the other car didn't, and, you know, it was a 1-2, which was great to be part of, you know, Bentley's return to racing and to have a 1-2 as a Bentley boy. Unbelievable, you know, but it was gut-wrenching for us to finish second. We had the fastest car, but, you know, it doesn't always win, does it, at Le Mans?
Okay, let's take a question from Kip. Nice, simple name, I like it. Kip wants to know about Jeff, actually. He says that he's always followed yours and Jeff's careers, and in fact he remembers catching his hat from the podium at the 1988 Road Atlanta race.
Brilliant.
That's Jeff's hat, I imagine.
Yeah, yes. It wouldn't be mine.
Exactly. You would have been back in...
I was here, actually, 88. I was doing Vauxhall Lotus or F3, yeah.
Okay, right. Sorry, I can't remember what happened an hour ago, sorry.
No problem.
Anyway... What's Jeff up to? He wants to know whether Jeff's going to be part of the resurgence of Brabham.
No, he's just flat out, you know, helping Matthew's career.
Okay.
Obviously, he's you know, kind of positioning himself now back in America because he lived there for some time, went to Australia when Matthew was born. And now Matthew's racing and has done very well in the States. You know, his focus is fully on him. Obviously, I keep him up to date with, as well as Gary, just what's going on. But this is very much 100% my deal. So, yeah.
Okay.
Any chance of my brother putting any money towards this? You know what I mean? He wanted to, you know, because on our crowdfunding campaign, we started from £1 to £10,000 as contributions. He wanted a 50% discount on the one pounder. That's my brother.
We should ask you where you're at with the project in terms of crowdfunding, because it's been successful, hasn't it? It's really worked.
Yeah,
well,
I mean,
you.
It's, you know, you come up with a new idea and you're just not quite sure how people will take to it. And, you know, I like I said, I always felt there was a change as needed. You know, we've got to look at another way of having a race team survive. Crowdfunding gave us the seed money to get the ball rolling. It engaged a community straight away with what we are doing. We've had like nearly 3,000, I think about 3,000 people now from 64 countries have contributed. Really just off an idea. You know, this is our idea. This is what we would like to do. This is not a finished product saying, right, here's a team, we're going to do this and this and everything's up and running. This is about starting the journey now, but come and be part of it. You know what I mean? And so it's very much done its job. We set a target at 250. We got 278. There's a bit more come in, obviously, since then. You know, we're very busy at the moment, you know, trying to get partners involved in our Brabham Digital experience. Because that's a big program. You know, we're talking to manufacturers about LMP2 cars. We're looking at factories where we're going to position ourselves in with a factory. There's a hell of a lot to do. But, you know, we keep our community updated. You know, I was on the train writing down what's happened since crowdfunding finished. To give out to our community of you know, what the type of people we're talking to, the things we're looking at, just to keep them involved.
Yeah. Exciting, isn't it?
I think it's so. I mean, for me, I get a real buzz from the whole thing because I really see an opportunity, and for me, it opens up a whole array of commercial opportunities as well, you know, because we are talking to education at the same time. How can we engage a community of students to learn through the team? You know, what something that's exciting to learn through, you know.
Let's take one last question. This comes from Joe Pro. Yes, I know. Anyway, he wants to know the best sports car you ever drove. That's the Jag, I guess.
Correct.
Okay. And... The best Formula One car you ever drove. That's a bit tougher, isn't it? Shall we leave that one? Or?
Well, no, actually, I drove a few. I drove the footwork. I was a test driver for footwork, which wasn't... It was a bit pitch sensitive, and Alan Jenkins didn't like that word when I said it's a bit pitch sensitive, but it was. But it wasn't a bad car, and then they improved it after that. That with a Mugen engine, yeah, it wasn't bad, you know. And I didn't drive a Formula One car for like 3 years, and then a phone call came out of the blue, and it was in 97. I'd just come back from Japan doing the 1,000 kilometers out there in August and died, you know, with the heat in the panels, as you can imagine. I got home literally within a week, and Tony Dow rings up, who was involved with Tom and working with Bridgestone at the time, and I got invited to go over to test at Suzuka in a year old Ligier doing tire testing. Okay. So, you know, that car, it wasn't the best, but it was all right, and it was great opportunity to, you know, do tire testing there. And not having been in an F1 car for 3 years, that wasn't an easy thing to jump back into. You know, it takes time. And I remember getting to the end of the first day thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get through the next day, because my neck was just gone. You know what I mean? So I got up and thought, right, you know, just keep pushing. And, you know, my first lap out was as quick as I did the day before. And then we had an engine problem. That was the end of the test. So that was the last time I drove an F1 car.
And now you've just been to see Ligier again, literally.
Yeah, yes.
Well, what
a different Ligier, but...
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Rob, we've actually got a question from Ed Foster at the far end of the room, who's just given me a scrawl on a piece of paper, which I can just about read. He's asking what the panels was actually like to drive. I seem to remember we discussed with Messrs. Weaver and Wallace that it was like an oven, and doing more than one stint at Le Mans was always hard work. But I mean, what are your recollections?
I think, had the most beautiful line about, as James would in his beautiful English. He said, when you drive a Panos, you lose the will to live. It was damn hot. It wasn't easy to drive. I would say there was only a few of us that could get the most out of it. Anyone coming in was just that little bit off, because it was so different, so weird, you know, sitting on the rear axle like that, and you're moving around and stuff. But if you know, certainly for Jan and I, we were the main drivers, so we were in it quite a bit, so we got used to it. But anyone coming in found it tough. Eric Bernard was very good in it, actually. He was, he was an excellent driver.
We've never really talked a lot about that whole Panos thing. I mean, it's an extraordinary... The whole story is amazing, isn't it? I mean, an individual like that and all that money, it's amazing.
I remember reading about it in an auto sport. And it was a little... I remember it was on the inside page. It was just a little column, had a picture of it, and it said, you know, front engine Panos. And, of course, my dad... Yes. You know, in the 60s, yes. Threw the engine out of the front and put it in the back with Cooper. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I remember reading it long before I'd done a deal. And I think, well, you never see me in that thing. So I turned the page, you know. And if it wasn't for Dave Price's persistence to get me in the seat, it would never have happened.
What about the noise? As well.
Sorry, what was that?
The noise. Yeah. But you know, given the fact your dad came out with hardly any hearing from motor racing, you know, there was some irony there that you ended up in a bloody Panos of all things.
Yeah, I know. I learned a lot living with a deaf father, to be honest with you. I mean, because even when I was karting, I had earplugs. Right. A lot of kids don't, which is not the right thing. And I came up with an idea of sewing in my balaclava some sponge. So I did that and sewed it on with, you know, a cut-up piece of Nomex underwear and got it all done, because that with the earplugs did help. If I didn't have it on, boy, I did notice a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was late 90s when I did that. And, of course, now you can buy them. You can, I think, Sparco do them, you know. But I think it should be compulsory, because the damage to our ears in a racing environment, it's stupid, you know. Why we keep going down these paths and not doing something about it just baffles me sometimes.
Tell us a little bit about Don Panos. I don't really know a lot of his. Speaking personally, I don't know a huge amount about him apart from what he did and how he made his money. I mean, was he very, very involved all the time?
No, not necessarily. Enough to upset things, you know. not really. No, I'm just joking. He has a very different view to life to a lot of people.
Okay.
Yeah, he is an entrepreneur. He thinks outside the box. He gets excited by challenging the way people think and do things. And, you know, if someone said to him, I'm sure it was probably Adrian Reynard, who, when he said, you know, I want to put the engine in the front, and Adrian said, well, that'll never work. Well, I'm going to show you it's going to work. You know what I mean? That was his mentality. You know, you don't become a billionaire by being stupid, you know what I mean? And, you know, he had a very different twist to things. He didn't understand the sport. Like, you know, you meet people who just get it. Mm-hmm. He didn't get it at the time. It didn't, you know, he just couldn't. You just see that was just that bridge, this gap between the real racing and what he thought it was, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, which was kind of probably good in some way because he had a different perspective. Sometimes we can be a bit too close to it and can go down these paths and someone from the outside goes, what the hell are you doing that for? Let's go this way. And a very interesting character. I got on well with him and his wife Nancy really well. And I had, you know, from not really looking at that picture thinking I'd never drive for a car like that, I ended up with 6 years at Panos. And we were a small team. It was a great team, really just terrific team. We were really hungry to win.
Yeah.
Everybody was on it. You know, driving with Jan Magnussen was a great, great pleasure. You know, we had one of those relationships where I do all the development and, you know, set up work because I love all that sort of stuff and I know I'm good at it. And it's like I come in, Mags was there, fag in his mouth in the pit lane, and he'd look at me and go, is it ready, Brabs? he'd stub the fag out, jump in the car, go like a bloody rocket, you know what I mean? And we both pushed each other all the time because, you know, if he was half a tenth quicker than me, he'd look at me and go, so what was it like to be spanked today, Brabs? You know, and then it'll be my turn, you know. And we just had a fantastic relationship. And, you know, Chris Gorn was our engineer and we just really gelled, which I think sometimes made it difficult for the other car with other teammates coming in because we were the focus. But we were driven and we were up against Audi.
Yeah.
And that was our high motivator. Beat Audi if we can, you know. And when they faltered just a bit, boom, we got them. Yeah.
It's a great story, Panos, actually. Yeah, yeah. And it also made, I mean, it was the absolute saviour of Jan as well. I mean, he became a hero in Denmark again for the second time after the disappointment of Formula One. So just a great thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, I guess when I saw Jan first, not really know who he was till he was in the team. You know, he wasn't my teammate at that point. He was in the other car. I could see why within the Stewart Grand Prix organization, it just didn't, you know, it was like putting a square block into a circle. Yeah. You know what I mean? It just didn't fit. And you know what? I mean, I think there's a few of us actually that have come out of Formula One and gone into sports cars and gone, actually, this is a lot better. You know what? We just totally enjoyed racing in America. The American Le Mans Series was a really great series. Really,
I would have thought it'd be just the right thing for Mark Webber as well. You know, that kind of atmosphere.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I know Mark. I've had some conversations with him, and he's really enjoying sports cars.
Yeah.
You know, he did fantastically well in Formula One. You know, he had a great career. You know, achieved a lot, and then he's gone into sports cars as one of the top names, and he's enjoying life, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
He's a bit sore at the moment, but you know.
Yeah. Did you were you watching it? Did you see any of that live?
I was kind of in and out watching it, and then I had to go off. And then when I came back, it was someone texted me, I think, and said, "Boy, that was a big shot from Mark." And I've kind of looked at it, and I ran to the TV as I came in, and they were just literally talking about it, but they didn't see it. So then I had to find a YouTube clip to find it, and of course you go, "Oh, you know what?
Oh, absolutely!
Wow, that was a big one."
They had a commercial break, and they came back from the commercial break, and the first picture from back from Brazil was just the wreck sitting there with fire and everything else. I thought, Jesus. Is that
not what you want to see?
No,
it
no,
doesn't
no,
matter what driver it is.
No,
you know, when you know that driver.
Absolutely.
Bad place to go off.
Yeah, but I think he went off there
he
in
did
a Jaguar, didn't he?
2003 in a Jaguar.
He did, and then Alonso went over the wreckage. It turned into a bit of a multiple, didn't it? It was a huge shunt there.
But after, when I saw it, I did text him. I said, "What is it with sports cars and big shunts with you, mate?" You know?
Can't resist.
But we said before we started recording, you know, this is a good time for you coming in as a team owner to sports cars. I mean, it's really on the up, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see. You know, I mean, as we know, in sports cars, it goes in circles. You know, 1 minute it's up, 1 minute it's down. It's definitely on and up. You know, the manufacturers are getting back involved, and you know, they'll pump millions into marketing. You know, so it's good for the series, good for everybody involved. It's exciting for Brabham to be coming back to racing, but also into a series that's starting to come up. And of course, you know, one day I'd love to see Brabham back in Formula One. That's a long way down the road, but it, you know, Formula One and Brabham, you know, it's in its DNA, you know, and you know, obviously it's not achievable at the moment, but you know, in 10 years' time, who knows, you know.
Can I just ask you a question about your dad? Lost him this year, and I've always thought about him. There are certain drivers, really great racing drivers, who seem to me to be curiously underrated by history, and I've always thought that about your dad. Do you have the same impression?
I think that's
Sterling. When I was talking to Sterling about it, he said absolutely. God knows why he is, but you're right.
Yeah,
well, he wasn't a marketing man, was he?
No, hardly. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think. For Dad, when I think about what he achieved and how he achieved it, is pretty amazing. When I turned 40, I thought when Jack was 40, he was winning his third world championship. He's also winning the Formula 2 championship in a Brabham Honda. He's also got the biggest racing car manufacturer in the world. To manage and do. He's testing all the cars, all the bits and pieces. Then he's got to jump into a Grand Prix car and race against Clark and, you know, Graham Hill and John Surtees and Jackie Stewart. And we're at the peak of there. They weren't doing what Jack was doing.
Well,
nowhere near it. You know what I mean?
And
I think Dad... at the memorial, the first thing that he said, I learned how to win... by going the slowest possible speed. And I think he thought to survive in that era and to win, he had to play a smart game. So he wasn't as spectacular as some of the other guys, although there were races in the wet at the Nürburgring.
He certainly could be. I mean, races
yeah, when he
I
turned
remember.
It on,
yeah.
When he turned it on, no, they couldn't beat him. Yeah. You know what I mean? And of course, he'd get out of the car. He'd be more interested in, you know, talking with Ron, who, you know, without Ron, Dad would never have achieved what he achieved. But, you know, they would go off together back in the workshop. You know, he wasn't going off PR mode or anything like that. And I just think all those little things that he kind of did just took him off people's radar as, oh, who's a superstar driver, you know. And I think that played a role. It was his character. He was straight down the line. Yeah. Told it was as it was. Didn't say much. But when he did it people listened. Yeah. You know, definitely.
David, are there any plans in the longer term? You're talking at the moment about running a sports car team with maybe a customer chassis from Ligier or whoever. But I mean, are the plans in the longer term maybe to set up a place in Chessington and put a Brabham badge on a car nose again?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, further down the road, we've talked about in our program becoming a manufacturer in Formula One, in sports cars, in LMP1. But, you know, because we're a kind of open-sourced race team where people can get involved, you know, we're talking to companies now about collaborative design software that allows people to help contribute to designing a race car of the future. So
Adrian Newey could join in.
Well, he could put in an application, yeah. I mean, you know, or Ross Brawn, yeah. I mean, you know, we'll look at it, we'll interview them, yeah. But, you know, this whole program's about engaging a community, inspiring a community of engineers. You know, engineering in this country's got a problem. You know, there's not enough engineers, English engineers, or, you know, I think in 6 or 7 years, it's going to be 50% down of where it really needs to be.
Which is what Richard Noble's been saying for many years.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so, you know, with the Bloodhound program and, you know, Williams announcing what they're doing, trying to find the next, you know, Adrian Newey or Ross Brawn. Where we need programs like that out there in the marketplace, and Brabham is trying to do its bit as well.
That's great. You know? Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's good fun. We could talk a lot more, couldn't we, actually? It's been a really what a great podcast to end the year on. Thank you, David, very much indeed.
I think we all wish you the best of luck with the project, because it's really good to see what you're trying to do, and it's good to see the Brabham name back.
Yeah, thank you. I have to say the you guys, the whole of the media have really got behind it. You know, we haven't found any real negativity to what we're trying to do, which has been fabulous. You know, thank you not just to the fans that have contributed and been involved, and, you know, people can still be involved. You know, they can still buy the pre-order the sort of digital packages in advance to be part of the team. And it's growing, and there's a lot to do, but it's an exciting future.
Perhaps we should put all those details on the website, should we, Mr. Website Editor? We should. Yes, he's giving. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Damien, Simon, Nigel, Ed, thank you very much for putting all our podcasts together this year. And to Alan, sitting quietly in the corner every time, making sure you can hear us. And we'll be back in January 2015 with another Motorsport Magazine podcast. Thank you so much for your support this year. We do need it, and we love it. See you soon. All right.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.